Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have for a second go-around on the Teaching Journeys podcast, Michael Gersh. Let me tell you a little bit about Michael. Michael Gersh is a survivor of a drunk driving crash that killed his mother and nearly himself when he was 8 years old. Despite breaking almost all his bones in the crash, he went on to become a collegiate swimmer, comedian, speaker, author, college educator, and photographer. Raised in Miami, Florida, he attended Ashland University on a swimming scholarship, where he earned a bachelor's degree in communications. Michael earned his master's degree in higher education administration from the University of Akron. He has been at Kent State University for 24 years and is a senior advisor for the College of Aeronautics and Engineering, where he advises the professional pilot major. With over 25 years' experience on stage as a comedian and speaker, Michael has presented his programs at schools, colleges, military bases, and two TEDx talk presentations. Michael has been presenting his program for 11 years at the Stone Municipal Court for first-time drunk driver offenders. He has been a guest on several national podcasts regarding grief and trauma, speaking from the male's perspective. In 2015, he founded the Magic of Life Foundation, a nonprofit organization that helps his mission in eliminating impaired driving, making communities safer, and empowering people to make better choices in life. In 2019, he published his memoir, The Magic of Life, A Son's Story After Tragedy, Grief, and a Speedo. One Amazon reader said, "This book will inspire any reader to be a better person. This is one of the best books I have read in a long time." Michael's book can be bought on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And in addition to Michael, we have another special guest. We have Tigger. And so, Michael, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I know Tigger is significant for both of us, and since we're doing dual and Tiggers, I'm going to hold mine up. So here we go. And Dave, we talked about this during the last podcast in terms of the significance of Tigger in our own lives. With that, welcome again to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's just great to have you back.
Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it. And Tigger, thanks you too.
Well, you're welcome, man. My Tigger thanks your Tigger and you for being on the podcast for a second time around. So now that we've got the social niceties out of the way, we might as well get down to business. So I did have you on sometime, I think, beginning of last year, where we talked about the Magic of Life Foundation, your work, your transcending tragedy after the drunk driving accident that took your mom, and how you built yourself back up. So, and again, what I'm going to do is in the program notes for this podcast, I will include the audio episode link for our first podcast so that if individuals want to get more of the backstory on you, they can do that. And I suspect some of the backstory is going to come out as we talk about your latest TED Talk, which is Saved by Our Connections. So tell the audience, tell our listeners, what's been going on since the last time we talked? What's new with you?
I've been sitting here waiting for this one, just me and Tigger, just, you know, we ordered pizza, just waiting, and now here we are. In the last year or so, and I want to just thank you for your continuous friendship, because I think what we talked about last time, and then connecting with other people to do other podcasts, to share stories and to help others, that's been awesome. So doing other podcasts, sharing my story and trying to help other people. I did the second TED Talk at where I went to college at Ashland University in February. A lot more photography, which has been fantastic. I have an exhibit coming up next month in September at City Hall here in Cuyahoga Falls. So it's been pretty cool. And just trying to live a life and being happy and trying to shed some pounds that I can never escape. And, you know, just enjoy life and, you know, and try to make a difference while doing it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times, particularly in these times that we're facing, it's difficult for a lot of individuals, I think, to embrace the joy in life, but we really have to consciously do that. Because I think the more we can embrace the joy, the more good things manifest for us and the more people we attract in our life who are going to be, you know, manifesting that same joy. So it sounds like you've got a pretty busy schedule.
Sometimes, you know, but there are times where I like my afternoon naps on the weekends and, you know, we all need to reset and do that. So, but between the things I enjoy doing, whether it's stand-up comedy, I'm working this weekend at a club here in town, you know, trying to perform and the program. So I think there's still enough time to just take a moment and breathe. And I also enjoy that part.
Yeah. And I think we need to take that time for ourselves just to kick back, breathe, relax, and do nothing. Tell me, Michael, what inspired the creation of your Saved by Connection TED Talk? Why now? Why was this important for you to bring this out now?
Well, once I heard the theme for the TED Talk, which was sparking connections or sparking our connections, I really wanted to focus on connections in my life that had such an impact, such like Tigger, being a role model, you know, as a kid and taking those principles and those people that really helped me and also saved my life too. You know, I started with talking about my mom and the fact, you know, she gave me life, and unfortunately, I lost her when I was 8 weeks old in the car crash. And then moving on to a woman named Dolly, who came into our household to raise me, my brother, as her own flesh and blood, which was only supposed to be a part-time job and turn into a lifetime role for her. My friends in college, and also other friends that know who you are and know when you are hurting and you're trying to hide it, especially for men. When we try to hide that pain, my friend Ray, who I'm going to call her one of my best friends and also my personal photographer, when she was taking pictures of me at a fundraiser for the Magical Life Foundation, and she said, "We can't use these photos because you have sad eyes." And that was the same week where I thought I was done. It was, I had a plan to end it all. And I was just going through a lot of grief. My dad died in January of 18. My aunt died 90 days later. The fundraiser was June of 18. So it was in that early on grieving process. And I really didn't start grieving for my father. And my aunt passed away. And then I emulated what my dad did was hide that pain. I saw him hide that pain for 47 years. And that same week, it was the same week that Robin Williams passed away from suicide. And I had a plan just like him. And then I also had lunch with a friend of mine that was going to be, that turned out to be my grief counselor. And she said, "You don't look like yourself either." And, you know, those are the people in our lives. So, you know, when I say saved by connections, those are the people in our lives that will call us out. And those are the ones that care about us. And I realized that journey, looking back, constructing that podcast, those people that would miss me the most if I did something, you know, to myself or harm, and those who said you can't be a burden if you're ever feeling that way and have to feel ashamed, if you're feeling down, depressed, to go to those people in our lives that we know will always have our back. And I think it was very important just to put that together along with humor. So it was my mom, Dolly, and my friends from college, the rock band Kiss, and even, you know, my dad. So it was just a good broad scope of those people in my lives that mean so much to me. And we all have that. And I wanted to relay that to the audience that we have those people in our lives.
And you're right. I don't think anybody comes into our life by chance. I think it's all by the grand design, whether we believe in God's plan or the universe's plan. One of the things that, you know, when I read your book, The Magic of Life, it was almost the immediacy with which Dolly came into your life after your mom died. It was like your mom was taking care of you from the great beyond. and brought you Dolly to take up the slack that, you know, obviously she couldn't take up because of the accident. So, and I believe that. I think just everybody is in our life, even if it's for a moment in time, for a specific purpose at the time, and it gets us through the next moment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the car crash happened September of 1970. Dolly came into our lives November of 1970. So, you know, it was that quick, you're right. And then she's still here. I won't say how old she is because she'll beat me up, but she'll have a birthday next month. She's in her 90s. I will say that part, but I won't give us the specific one. But it's incredible to have her in my life. She's such a special person. And one of the reasons why I am the person I am today. So we can thank her or we can blame her. Either one works.
Yeah. I'm sure from what I know of her, she's got broad shoulders. So I think she'll be able to roll with anything you want to throw at her. So, you know, one of the things that, first of all, I am glad you did not go through with your plan for a lot of obvious reasons. One of the things that I deal with my students, and you know, I mean, working with a college age population, there's a lot of depression. There's a lot of occurrences of anxiety, suicidal thoughts. And I remember there was one student who I talked to in particular. This was years ago. She had more loss, Michael, probably at the age of 21, than a lot of people experience in a lifetime. And she basically was very open about thinking about suicide. And when I told her, and she goes, who would miss me? The message was, who would miss me if I was gone? I said, well, so I could tell you one person who would be saddened by your absence, and that would be me. So if you're thinking that nobody's going to miss you, know that I am going to miss you. Today, she is in a relationship. She's working. And she's expecting her first child. So,
wow.
I think when we talk about suicide, we're opening up the conversation to say, talk me out of it. Give me a reason to keep going out, even if it's for an hour, even if it's for a day. Tell me that I can still make a difference.
Right. Yeah. And I say, you know, if you can make a difference in someone's life through humor, you know, then you're doing something pretty special. And you know, there's something worth, you know, and, you know, with students for so long, you never know that one person you're going to have that positive impact on. And when you do, and you know about it, it's a pretty amazing feeling to have. And I see that when we do our court program, for the DUI offenders, where they come in, they're upset, they don't want to be there, but you watch them change that 90 minutes and they come up and they shake your hand or give you a hug or whatever it is. And that's when you know your story, your purpose has an impact on others. And I think we all have that ability to share our story with someone and make that impact. It could only be, maybe it's only one person in your life. That's a pretty good blessing to do.
Yeah, and particularly your story is very relatable. You express your story in a way that people are going to connect with it because you're very down to earth. It's a very human approach. You mince no words. And individuals who have experienced all kinds of trauma, who have come from chaotic environments, who have had addiction, all they want is that honesty and consistency. And if you can give that to them, at least it may not change their behavior, but it's going to plant some seeds where it's going to at least make their future decisions a little bit more difficult to make. They're at least going to think about it. Before,
right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the strength that we love seeing in them, especially if they hit, you know, unfortunately, they hit rock bottom, as you know, and it takes maybe it's a 20-year in that hole, and then they finally hit that bottom and they find that strength to ask for help. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And to find that strength in myself to ask for help was probably the best thing I ever did. I was on Aletha's podcast not too long ago, and she made me cry, you know, because she asked me this question about, like, one of the best, you know, things I did for myself. I said, ask for help, because I wouldn't be here, you know, if I didn't. And I think everyone has that. And it goes back to saved by our connections, you know, find that connection, that one person you know you could go to and ask for help. And we all have at least one person that we could go to.
Was there any one connection that stands out that facilitated the way for the way for you or paved the way for you to ask for help? Or was it all of your connections in general and combination that helped you break that barrier?
The biggest two on that day was Dolly and my brother, because I said, I can't send them back to the cemetery three times within 6 months. And that was the beginning of it.
Was there also, and correct me if I'm wrong, but was there some other type of non-ordinary phenomenon experience that you had prior to contemplating taking your own life? Was there a dream? Am I recalling this?
I did have a dream many years ago, in my early 20s, where things weren't going very well and I wanted to meet my mom. You know, I wanted to hear her voice and all that stuff. And I went to bed thinking I was going to jump off the 15th floor balcony the next morning. And then she came to me in the dream and said, she said, Michael, I'm fine. Stop worrying about me. And she gave me a hug. And I woke up face down the pillow like this, like I was hugging her. And that really helped as well back then. And I still think about that too, thinking, okay, I don't think my mom, and I believe that my mom sacrificed her life so I could live, like any good parent would do, that she did something that split second before that car hit us to save my life. She gave me birth, she saved my life. And so those are the things I kind of think about as well. But in that instant, it was back then in 2018, it was definitely my brother and Dolly.
Well, good. My recall wasn't all that off then. I knew there was something, but so right. Obviously you had contemplated suicide prior to, you know, earlier in your life too.
Yeah, that depression was there. And, you know, when I was doing the book and going back to these memories and those type of things, especially talking about mental health, and I had to take that deep dive into it and be honest with not only myself, but also then the reader to convey it. Because we both know, when people go through depression and they think about those things, they think they're the only ones going through it alone, and as we talked about. And then as soon as you find out there's other people that feel that same way, there's sort of like security in that, or, oh, I'm not alone in this journey. And that's nice. So I had to go back and think about those things. And I remember that life was, I was, you know, early 20s, mid 20s, 26, 27-ish, probably. It was just one of those things. And, you know, as an infant, the time of the crash and growing up, not hearing my mom's voice and, you know, all those type of things, or laugh. And as a comedian, I made many people laugh, but the one laugh I never heard was my mom. Those are the things that will get to you. And then you kind of go, all right, let's see what's on the other side. You know, is it better? And then you realize your parents or your loved ones, even though they're not here, will still protect you.
And the dream visit that you had with your mom is powerful evidence of that. That's one of the more, I think, powerful forms of after-death communication or signs from our loved ones. When our loved ones come to us in a dream visit, we're having a conversation with them, and it's very realistic. And you get the message that, look, I'm okay. I'm always going to take care of you. We're going to see each other again. And your mother, I would suspect your mother is not going to stop being your mother for as long as you live. She may end up manifesting at another time where you're at a crossroads. Tell me more about KISS. You have this really just, I think, very unbelievable connection with that band. I know you went to their final concerts in Madison Square Garden. So tell our listeners, for those who like music and who like to connect, you know, with to their own live stream music. Tell us why KISS was so significant for you and still is.
Right. I should go get high. I should go get my Gene Simmons doll and put it next to Tigger.
Or get the face makeup and, right. You know.
Yeah. I'm very unprepared for today. I should have worn the makeup. Wrong my brother's fault. He introduced me to KISS. So I was seven. I was in second grade, 1977. And Destroyer came out, and you know, my brother's 3 years older than me. So of course he was into it. And then you see the makeup and, you know, all that stuff, and, you know, to a little kid, that's pretty cool. Then, you know, and then the music and the gravitation, and then learning what it stood for, because you would be picked on being a KISS fan at some point. But if you like something enough, or you believe in something enough, what they taught me was how to stand up for myself. along with, well, Kiss, and my role models like Tigger and Dolly, and you know, you stand up for it. And then it was just part of life, you know, and their music, and just the people I've met through the band, some of my closest friends, and the concerts are just so much fun because you go there, and once the lights go down, whatever's bothering you on the outside, gone for 2 hours. And you're just focused on having fun and being part of this life experience with 15, 20,000 other people. And, you know, my friends and I would joke, oh, hey, can you describe a Kiss concert? No, I can't. You just have to be there. And it's the imagery, but also about having fun in life, standing up for yourself, believed in yourself, those positive things. I think, you know, kept me gravitated towards the band. Do I think they should have stopped 20 years ago? Yeah, sure. But I still went, you know, and to be part of the, you know, the final two concerts with my, one of my best friends, Dennis, survived by Connections, you know, I don't know if I could put it into words. It was just very special to do that with one of my best friends who used to make fun of me for being a Kiss fan in college. So I kind of turned him around towards that, but you're part of that culture, and, you know, it's a little different than being, you know, a football fan of your favorite team, you know, the Steelers will make fun of the Browns and vice versa, but you stand up for what you believe in. And that was one of the things that Kiss taught me. And, you know, the music is, you know, for me, great. Not every song is great, right? But, you know, you're not gonna like everything your favorite group does. But I think music means something to us in different ways. And I think that helps with, like, being down, depressed, whatever it is. It can lift our spirits up. And I think that's a beautiful thing about listening to your favorite band, singer, you know, whoever, you know, it will change our mood quite frequently. And I think that's pretty awesome. So, but also Gene Simmons being a role model, never did drugs or alcohol. And, you know, and you see what they did as like, okay, if he doesn't have to do that and be successful, then I can emulate that too, especially in the world of comedy. Where there's a lot of alcohol and drugs. I love performing. I didn't like the lifestyle so much where you're out afterwards and you're, you know, you may be drinking with other comedians or, you know, the audience members. And you see that through those eyes and kind of go, all right, if it worked for him, maybe he doesn't have to work, you know, maybe the same thing for myself. So that kept me out in terms of, you know, abusing myself with alcohol and drugs, but also my, you know, my backstory too. But I think that was a positive influence. Seeing that my entire life through the band.
Yeah, and for me, it would be groups like, you know, groups like the Wallflowers, Rush. Those were musicians that helped me during, as you're aware, the most challenging time of my life, you know, after my daughter, Janine, and I call a transition to a new existence, that when she was 18 years old, and music provided me a lot of comfort. It allowed me to connect to my emotions. It allowed me to put, you know, some voice to what I was feeling at that particular time or what I was thinking. It influenced a lot of the writing I was doing at the time. But when you go to a concert as well, you're connecting to a community. You're talking 15,000 to 20,000 people who share that same passion for a particular band, whether it be Kiss or The Who or the Rolling Stones. And you want to talk about being connected to something greater than yourself, go to a rock concert and you can really connect to that. Something that is beyond ourselves, that is awe-inspiring, and connecting to something greater than ourselves, connecting to that type of community, I think helps us get through any kind of tragedy, however we define tragedy.
Yeah. And there's that energy at a rock, any concert, I guess, even like, look at what Taylor Swift's doing, you know, that energy. Yep. To release, and that whatever's, you know, say the negative energy walking in and you release it all and you feel exhausted after a concert and you leave and you're smiling and you look like other people, you don't have to say a thing, but you see the happiness in each other's eyes.
Yep.
That's awesome. You don't have to communicate. You don't have to do any verbal communication. You just kind of go, you know, you look at them going, okay, that was well worth it. And I feel much better.
Yep. For me, one of the greatest moments I had at a rock concert was watching Neil Peart of Rush do a drum solo. I mean, that'll be forever etched in my memory, because for me, he was the the best drummer of my generation. So, but it's those moments and those moments add up that help us get through the tough moments.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Talk to us about, from your perspective, what is the difference between how males handle grief, handle tragedy, and our female counterparts?
Women are much better at releasing the information a lot easier. Because I think the social norms are like that, right? Men are supposed to be taught stoic. If you share your feelings, it's a sign of weakness. And that hasn't changed, even though the discussion of it in the last 20 years or so has changed. Those social norms are still there. So I think it begins as kids, really. Whether you're watching football and, stoic, but then you watch people win the Super Bowl and cry with all those emotions. But I think men are just taught not to share those emotions.
Yeah.
I think we're supposed to be strong like a rock and not open up. So I think women are much better at it. Cause they're also in most roles, not everyone, but it's changed the caregivers, mm-hmm. right? In life, the nurturers, with the children and everything else. So I think they're sometimes better. I wouldn't say better equipped might be not the right term, but better at it of practice, than men. But I think once men start practicing that, then it gets much easier. And I realized when I started talking about it and writing the book, it was like, what am I afraid of? Instead of depression controlling me, by opening it up and talking about it, it's like, well, this is nothing, to talk about it. And we both know the last year and other men that we talked to, it's like talking sports with each other. And that's a beautiful thing to do, to see how none of us are afraid to talk about emotions and grief and trauma mm-hmm. and depression, because we know I think it helps each other too.
Yeah.
It inspires me, but it's such a relief to mm-hmm. do it and go, what was I afraid of? So you told someone you were down, you weren't feeling well, you're depressed. Okay. Not the end of the world. And by doing so, God, I feel so much better, by releasing that tension. So I just think it's still the social norms, and we just have to get better at it and not so much afraid to share.
Yeah. And I think if we acknowledge the differences in the way men and women express emotions, we can understand it better. We can create space for it better. I'm a firm believer that we experience feelings just as intensely as females do. We just deal with it differently.
Yep.
If you ask a guy what they're thinking, they can tell you what they're thinking. Then from there, you can ask them how they feel about what they're thinking, and then they can tell you really easily.
Right.
But if you ask a guy, well, how you feeling? A lot of them won't go there because they don't have a vocabulary for it.
Yeah.
And what the connotations of feelings is feelings are equated with vulnerability, as you mentioned, a lack of strength. And we are supposed to take care of our loved ones. We're supposed to take care of everybody else. And when we see our loved ones grieving over a loss that we think we should have prevented, it just rips another hole right in our hearts, because it reminds men that, we didn't do our job as caretaker of our families. That's the farthest thing from the truth. The truth is that we did the best that we could given the hand of cards that were dealt with us. But we're so consumed with grief and the what ifs and the what should have beens that we think we should have done more. In reality, over time, we realize that we did the best we could.
You are exactly right. And as you're talking, I saw my father in that example, where if I had survivor's guilt, he had to have survivor's guilt for 47 years, and reliving that car crash every time. And you're right. He did the best he could as he was still going through that trauma and grief and never talking about it, never, getting, I wouldn't say getting off his chest. That's probably the worst example, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He wrote me, my brother, an email December 19th, 2012, which would have been the 48th wedding anniversary. And he said, even to that day, it was still too hard to talk about my mom.
Yeah.
And, it's a generational thing too, but it was 1970s, born in the 40s. That wasn't the culture. That wasn't what men did. And he had to carry around with that 47 years. So you're 100% correct. I, you know, in terms of, I think men try to do the best they can while still carrying that load.
Well, you know, back in the 70s, we didn't have support groups. You know, we didn't have 24-hour news. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have the resources that we have now. So basically in the 70s, we just, it was the gut it out and just move through it, or power through it syndrome. Now it's, there's a lot more resources for individuals who are grieving, for both men and for women. There, you know, we've increased that. So now there's more that it's available. But there's also the stigma of asking for help, that there's a stigma attached to that. And that, I think that transcends anything, whether you're talking about mental health, whether you're talking about loss. It's like, if I'm asking for help, is that also a sign of weakness? And I think that transcends the gender divide for me.
Yep. I would agree with you on that too.
One of the things that you mentioned in your TED Talk was building ourselves up after tragedy. And you had a couple of really, I think, good suggestions. So would you elaborate on what those suggestions are and how they can specifically help us build ourselves up after tragedy?
You know, I probably should have watched the TED Talk again to remember what the heck it was. I think it was about keeping your sense of humor was one of them. And being it, yeah, so I think keeping that sense of humor is important, because humor and laughing is a healthy way to cope. Instead of trying to abuse yourself with alcohol or drugs, if you can still laugh at this, whatever this is, I think that is a key to being healthy and that sort of like recovery type of stuff. I know when I was going through it, you know, I kind of lost my sense of humor, where usually on Facebook, I try to write a joke per day or something funny. Excuse me. And I didn't do that for a while. And that was hard, going, man, I can't even smile. I can't even laugh at stuff. And here I am, supposed to be a comedian, you know, like Tigger, and, you know, making shrimp ones, and, you know, having fun. And I couldn't do that. So I learned, you know, through my own process, you know, you got to keep that sense of humor, is one of it. And, I think that's key. And I think the other one is, don't forget who you are and the people that impact your life, you know, those connections, you know, our role models, say like Gene Simmons again, you know, that impact, those positive impacts on our life, not so much the negative ones, but, you know, think about that and don't, yeah, being key in terms of knowing who you are and who you want to become, also, and, you know, relying on your friends for that too. And the people that care about us is also key in terms of getting through trauma and tragedy and grief, and just on that road to being happier.
Yeah, I think that's sage advice. And by the way, those were the two things in your TED Talk.
All right.
So you got it. But hey, you know, we in the moment, those building blocks to serve, transcend tragedy could change depending on where we are and depending on where we are in our own growth and evolution. So if you had a couple of different ones, that's cool too. So
probably did, but I only had a certain amount of time in the TED Talk to do.
I know it's amazing in terms of how much you can get in such a short period of time. And I don't think people realize the amount of preparation that goes into doing that. I think it's probably hours of rehearsal and, you know, basically just having your talk pretty much right at the tip of your neurons, and just without any prompts or any notes in front of you. It's a process. And I don't think a lot of people realize the amount of work that goes into that.
It was hard because, you know, I didn't want to forget anything. And my biggest thing was to slow down, because I'm always a fast talker. And I remember on my bar mitzvah speech on the side, my dad would write, slow down. So I remember my TED Talk to slow down and speak clearly. And I thought I did 12 minutes. Like, I got done, it was like 17 minutes. So I went, oh, because the limit was 18. I was like, the worst thing in comedy is going over your time. So I was very conscious of that. And I was glad that I was still under 18, but I hit all the points I wanted to. And I was really happy with that one. especially, but you're right, because you have no notes, there's no, you know, you only practice on yourself, you know, in the mirror and, you know, those type of things. And I love creating new programs and then seeing that reaction with everyone. So I'm very happy that you enjoyed it.
Yeah. And I all you got to do is just got to just Google or just go to YouTube, type in your name and the TED Talk Saved by Connections, and it'll come up. It's well worth 18 minutes of your time to listen to that. So if you're going to leave our listeners with just one thing today, beyond what you've talked about in terms of the building blocks to get through tragedy, what would be one other thing you would leave our listeners with today, Michael?
Good question. Probably don't lose your inner child.
Yes.
Let's get our tiggers back up. Gosh, one thing, don't lose sight of who you are and that your life matters to so many other people. So when you are feeling down or depressed, you know, realize how precious your life is. I'm taking it from a kid, I'm taking it from a 54-year-old that almost died at 8 weeks, and knowing how precious this one life is, and knowing that people would miss you, as we talked about earlier. If you decided to do something to harm yourself, realize that your life means something to so many, just not one, but so many people, and just understand that.
Yeah, we never realize the impact that we have on somebody until, you know, we're gone, or until somebody tells us, you know. Sometimes it comes out of the blue, and I think we will all question the impact that we have, depending, you know, because we're humans, you know, we're living the human experience and we want to make an impact. And sometimes we question, have we made that impact? And I will go through that periodically myself, where I'll question that. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I'll get an email from a former student who said, hey, what you did, I still look at your class notes, or, you know, the conversation that we had when I was an undergraduate really helped me. We never know the number of lives we're going to touch in our lifetime.
100%. There was a gentleman in the DUI class 4 years ago, and the foundation, we have wristbands to say I pledge not to drive impaired. It has my mom's initials. It has Andrew Munchak, who is an 18-year-old high school grad who was killed by a drunk driver. Then you got Christine on your yes. podcast. One of my best friends, John Kelly, his initials. And this guy has never taken off that wristband in 4 years. And he sent me a picture of him wearing it maybe 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that really... now I might get emotional. That really hit me hard, because it goes back to the impact. And those are the days you're going to go, why am I still doing this program? Am I making a difference? And then you see that and you realize that's the person that was meant to hear your message or your story. And it leaves you speechless, but it also makes you happy that you shared, that you opened up, you allowed all this stuff in here to get out to help someone else. And it's priceless.
Yeah. And I know the significance that John had in your life, and I know how hard you fell after you found out that he had died. And I know that was just one of the series of events that brought you to the depths of despair. And again, saved by the connections that you had in your life, those connections, obviously, as we've talked about during this podcast, have gotten you to the point now where you are making a difference. You are making impact through your Magic of Life program, through your work with the DWI offenders in the Stowe Court. So keep doing what you're doing, Michael.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. And I thank you for the opportunity to share so we can make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And so my last question for you is, if our audience wants to get in touch with you, wants to find out what you have going on, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way, I have a new website. It's called, it's just michaelgersh.com. michaelgrshe.com. There's a link to the book on there. It's also on Amazon. You can get it on digital, but also, you know, format. And on there is a link to photography page too. So if you want to check out the photography that I do, which keeps me bonded to my dad. My dad was a huge photographer, so he introduced that to my life. And, you know, that connection to my dad is still strong. So we'll stay with that connection theme. But there's Fine Art America, where you can see my photography, Instagram. But if you go to michaelgersh.com, you'll see the links to Facebook, LinkedIn, photography, Instagram. And that's one way to get a hold of me.
Hey, check out Michael's photography. I mean, he does some really great nature shots. It's just really, it almost like you can put yourself in the scene very easily. That's how realistic your photos are and vivid they are. So, and your book, as I mentioned in the previous podcast that we did, I'll mention in this one, it's a great book. If you really want to hear the story of somebody who really literally brought himself back from the depths of despair and transcended multiple losses in his life and did it with humor, with grace, and with dignity, Magic of Life is the book for you. So, Michael and Tigger and I want to thank Tigger and you for being a guest on the podcast. And I hope we can do this for a third time sometime.
I hope so too. That'd be fun. I love having our conversations, and that's exactly what this is. So, I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, anytime. And thank you for spending time with me and my listeners today. And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. Tigger and I wish you peace.